This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Going into the offseason, not knowing what's going to happen, took a lot longer figuring out what team I was going to be with than I probably would have liked, but couldn't be more happy to be here with the Chicago Cubs and get an opportunity to play for another storied franchise. And, you know, obviously love the team, love the makeup, love what they've done, and looking forward to an opportunity to win a division and make a playoff run.
Is voice of your newest Cub, first baseman, third baseman, infielder, pinch hitter, however you want to look at it, Justin Turner. Justin Turner is here. He's there. You heard from him. And now, joining us on the Circus Sports Illinois Hotline is Ben Verlander, host of the Flippin' Bats podcast. Download the Circa app today. And when dealing with Justin Turner, thank you for joining me, Ben. When dealing with him, the question is this. Is it more Duck Dynasty or more ZZ Top?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's more, I'm going to give him the benefit of saying ZZ Top for sure.
There we go. All right. That's I'm sharp-dressed man and like that. And now he comes to the Cubs when he could have been a Yankee because they allow facial hair. So the idea of Justin Turner coming here as the consolation prize for having the fourth best bid for Alex Bregman out of four teams, which means last place. What did you think of about the way that came down? Boston aggressive, too aggressive. They needed to do this. The Cubs too slow. They should have done this. How do you assess the Bregman Derby?
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I feel like for a while it started off as like, could the Astros happen? And then when they traded Kyle there and then, you know, brought in Paredes and brought in Christian Walker, it was kind of, okay, Astros isn't happening. So then you hear Tigers and Red Sox, and then it turns more to Tigers and Cubs. And it just kind of became a little bit of chaos, honestly. Had no idea what direction it was going to go in. Started getting to the point where it sounded like it was more and more going to happen with the Cubs, and then it doesn't. And you know, I heard Bregman say it, you know, 30 minutes before the decision was made, I thought I was going somewhere else. And I don't know where that was. He didn't say where that was, but who knows? But that's just to show you how back and forth it truly was. So Yeah, I would just say it was chaos. And in the end, I was a bit surprised it ended up being the Red Sox. I was thinking it'd be Tigers or Cubs.
Did Cubs come off like the third largest market, like a big market team in that competition? Are they did they look like they were a team that was offering to pay as its city stature could have demanded it?
Yeah, the more I think about it, the less I hate their offer. And I heard, you know, when we started talking, you said it was the fourth best offer. I don't know about that. From what I heard, it was 4 for $120, I think, and Red Sox were at 3 for $120. But the more I look into that deal, the Red Sox deal, he's getting $20 million deferred each year that he's there, and that doesn't start for 10 years, and it'll be paid out over 10 years. So I think if we're talking present-day money, I don't know if the Red Sox deal was the best. AAV-wise, it was, and I would say the Cubs was better than the Tigers AAV-wise because of the 4 years. So, I think the Cubs were extremely competitive. I think it was I think the Astros offer was just on the table originally and just kind of left there like, hey, we're willing to bring you back if you want to come back. But I felt like the most serious offers out there were Cubs, Red Sox, and Tigers battling it out. And I do feel like the Cubs offer was competitive. Now, the fact that they, you know, turned that around and after they didn't get them said, yeah, you know, we're not going to turn this money around and spend it in multiple places. Like we were after Bregman and only Bregman. I don't know if that's the best way to go about it. I think they have a team that's capable of winning the NL Central. But yeah, here we are.
My guest is Ben Verlander, host of the Flippin' Bats podcast. And by the way, I love this, Ben, on your Instagram. The bio includes, just be a good person. It's not hard. I love that. What prompted you to put that there, even though it's a truth and it's a true fact?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The social media world is, I spend a lot of my time on social media, and there's just a lot of, I don't even want to say bad people. There's just people that think because it's social media, it's easy to get by saying whatever you want and being a bad person and tearing someone down and being negative. Negativity sells on social media, and everything I do with my show, with whatever, is kind of the opposite of that. I don't buy into that. I'm going to be negative to get views and to get clicks. It's not the way I believe to go about things. So I try not to do that. And just kind of a reminder on my Instagram is just like, let's all take a second and just be kind to each other, even though we're behind a keyboard, you know?
I love that. It might be better labeled anti-social media, but that's not why you called. I want to ask, get your opinion. You pitched, you stared this down. The robot umps were, I know they're not actually robots, but the robot umps, that's a language that everybody understands. It went into play in Major League spring training games. What did you see and what do you think of this?
Yeah, so I feel like this has been a conversation for a few years at this point. And I would say what I was hoping for a couple of years ago was what we're seeing right now. I don't want a complete overhaul of the game and the human element in games. I don't want no umpire behind the plate. I don't want catchers to lose the art of framing. You know, we start shifting away from what baseball truly is when that happens. But what I do want is the ability to not have a game end on Angel Hernandez calling strike three with the bases loaded on a pitch that's a foot and a half outside. Now, that can't happen for two reasons. Angel Hernandez retired. I'm just using him as a reference, as we all know. But also that won't happen anymore because what I think this is designed to do is to eliminate the egregious, incorrect call in a massive moment in a game. And if it works out as I think it should, then I'm all for what we see. Just the challenge system, get the challenge. You have a couple. If you win, you keep them. But what I could see happening, and I think Vinny Pasquantino said it today, we're going to have to take this away from pitchers because those guys are going to challenge everything. And so I like it a lot. I think it's going to be great, and I think fans are going to love it. I think the fact that you put Hawkeye up immediately on the big screen, on the TV, and it takes, on average, I think I saw 13 to 17 seconds, I think people are going to love it.
Not even that. Pitcher, we saw Cody Poteet, and he tapped his head. Randazzo tapped his hat. They turned it around, and there you go. You got your answer. I don't know if it even took 10 seconds. But I'm bothered by the challenge system. I was hoping for a complete, essentially a K-zone for everybody. And here's why. You've taken the mound. When you have a scout, when you take the mound, you have a scouting report on the other team. You also have a scouting report on the umpire. If there is no umpire calling, if there's no human umpire calling balls and strikes, then the scouting report on the strike zone remains the same at home, on the road, no matter what it is, not influenced by you're a visiting pitcher and they're in their home and whatever, not influenced by whether it's the way Maddox and Glavine and Smoltz used to get 5 feet on either side of the black to be able to throw strikes. It's the same strike zone for everybody, hitters and pitchers, and they know. And I would think that would be much more uniform. That's what I would have liked. And I want to know what you think about that.
Yeah, more uniform, sure. But I would argue that baseball is not that. Baseball is not uniform. I could go to Fenway Park and it looks way different than Yankee Stadium. I could go to Wrigley Field and it looks far different than Camden Yards. Like, baseball isn't uniform. I don't know if it's meant to be uniform. I think once you start taking the human element out of the game completely, it's like, well, what are we doing? Why do we even need these guys? Why do we need umpires on the bases? We can just put lasers in the, you know, lasers out there and sensors in the bases and everybody can make the call for us. And maybe that is the direction it's going. Maybe that is the way we can go. But I just think if you do that, if you go full automated strike zone, what's the point of a catcher? Then teams start evolving over time of like, well, why do we even need a catcher back there? Let's just put like somebody standing, like somebody, like, you know, somebody just there with a normal glove. They don't even need to be sitting normally. A catcher position would change as a whole. There's no umpire back there besides to make maybe calls that safer out at home plate. I personally think that changes a little bit of the game too much and takes the human element fully out of it. So I don't know, but I hear what you're saying. I think that's the age old argument, and I enjoy talking to people that that think like you do, because you and I have the different perspective, right? I like the challenge system. You want full automated strike zone, and there's plenty of people listening right now that don't want any, and say get it all out of the game. So I think it's a fun, healthy conversation, and I enjoy that perspective.
Well, the challenge system is, I think they should add one to each team, because for exactly the situation you described with Angel Hernandez, you don't want to be out of challenges in the bottom of the ninth on a 3-2 count. You want to have that. You want to keep that in your pocket.
100%, and that's where it's going to get interesting. If we see it right now in spring training, we see Poteet out there, and this isn't – I mean, he ended up being correct. But, like, a pitcher is going to think – look, egos are going to get involved, right? They're just going to. And pitchers think a lot of pitches are strikes that are actually balls. And in a big situation, let's say it's – bottom of the second inning with runners on second and third and two outs and a full count, pitcher thinks a pitch is a strike and it's called a ball. He challenges, it is a ball, and then you lose that challenge and then you don't have one later. It's going to happen all the time. So we're really going to have to evolve, and teams are going to have to really talk about this of like, look, if it's close, if it's borderline early in the game, you can't challenge. We have to save them for the important ones late in the game. And I think pitchers that don't care about later in the game because they're pitching in the second inning and not the ninth inning are going to make sure their ERA stays low, so they want that pitch called for them.
So, yeah, we're going to have to take the driver's licenses away from starting pitchers. That's what exactly teams are going to think. Right?
Yeah.
So before I let you go, I'm talking with Ben Verlander, host of the Flippin' Bats podcast. And he flipped out when the Vladdy Guerrero, when the contract issue came up and the Blue Jays, and what happens here is, hey, maybe we can get him. Maybe we think we're fans of a team. We're also the home of the Cubs, Cubs radio broadcast, and we think a big market team should get every big name player that comes out there, and Vladdy Guerrero would certainly be, if they're going to trade for him, here we go. We're looking at a shutdown. Get him for whatever number of years you got, the same way you did with Kyle Tucker. So whatever the Blue Jays are doing, is it to set up a trade? Is it just to hold on? Is it, what are they doing, and what are the chances he gets dealt?
Yeah, you have to think high at this point. I mean, what's the point of not extending him if your plan is to keep him? Because he would be way cheaper a week ago than he's going to be in November. Unless you're saying, like, I don't know if he's the most consistent player in the world. Maybe he has a down year. But then that's just showing your guy you don't believe in him. So I think you should have signed him before the season. So now it's like, well, I feel like you have to trade him, right? This is the same sort of situation. I'm not saying they're the same caliber of player, but it's the same thing with Shohei a couple years ago with the Angels. It's like, okay, well, trade him the year before if you're not going to sign him. And they didn't. And then they didn't sign him that offseason. And then they didn't, again, trade him at the trade deadline. And it's like, what are you trying to get out of this? Just a comp pick in the draft? It makes no sense to me. So I think now that they didn't extend him, you have to trade him. You have to get something for him come the trade deadline, unless you're sitting in a pretty position in the AL East, which, you know, I imagine there'll be a few games over 500 and there's a outside chance they make the playoffs around the trade deadline. But I think you have to trade him because you didn't get a deal done. And it was, you know, it's frustrating to see them throwing around all this money to Shohei and Soto. And then when you have your homegrown in-house talent ready to sign a big deal, you don't get it done. It's a little odd to me.
Does the pending, whether you know it's a lockout or strike or whatever, with the work stoppage in another season after the 26th season figure into that? Nobody wants to be on the hook for massive amounts of money. They want lockout language. They don't think they can get it. I got to believe that's affecting some teams' approach to signing players to longer contracts than a year.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it is. You know, I do think there's a benefit of, you know, everybody's been saying this since the last lockout, since the COVID situation of, like, maybe wait till the next one, there's going to be a lockout. And I think that would be the worst possible thing for the game of baseball. And I think everybody knows that. And I think since COVID, attendance has skyrocketed. TV numbers have looked good. Revenue has looked good. The game is in a good spot. The absolute worst thing that could happen for the game of baseball, for everyone involved, for players, for front offices, is a lockout. So I hope it doesn't happen. I think there's a better chance that it doesn't than it does. And I would hope teams aren't going about business thinking about that. But you do bring up a good point. There is a chance of that, yeah.
Ben, I appreciate your time. Thanks for taking time out. And hopefully we'll get to talk throughout the summer. At least we know there will be a summer this year.
Absolutely. Appreciate you for having me.
Thanks. Ben Verlander, host of the Flippin' Bats podcast. And you were hearing him on Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. I need to tell you this, so listen up. The Slam Dunk in Vegas National Contest is easy to enter. All you got to do is this. Today, tomorrow, download the Odyssey app. You just have until the end of this weekend. Download the Odyssey app, log in, listen to The Score each day for a minimum of 1 hour for your daily entry for a chance to win this unforgettable trip for four during the first weekend of the tournament in March. Bang! Stay at Circa Resort and Casino, where you can visit the biggest March hoops party at Stadium Swim. Hey, wait, there's more. Airfare is also included, plus $20,000 to fund the ultimate viewing experience in Vegas. I'm going to take a break. When I come back, I have some thoughts You talk with Jack O'Callaghan, Miracle on Ice, defenseman for the 1980 U.S. Olympic team on this date 45 years ago. Hockey David defeated the Red Goliath. And we saw something, another international moment. But like that miracle, the NHL has never been able to capitalize on the miracle or international hockey moments, the breathlessness like you saw this week. I have some thoughts on that. Next, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
It's Saturday Suckage on 670 The Score. Here's your host, Steve Rosenblum.
For the old timers. Welcome and welcome back. Saturday Suckage. I suck so you don't have to. Alex Kuhn helping me along. He's staying on brand. He may show up here infrequently, but he sucks when he does. Thank you, Alex. The NHL's four-nation face-off, right? Four nations face-off. That's what we saw this week. It made the NHL, no all-star game, but it made it the talk of sports, right? USA, Canada, overtime! Spectacular, world-class talent. It was all over the place. And it was all the talk, right? But here's the thing. NHL has never figured out how to leverage great international games. Never figured out how to move the league's needle. Greatest sporting event in American history, 1980. U.S. Olympic team defeats the Soviets, wins the gold medal. Miracle on Ice. Do you believe in miracles? Today's the anniversary of that game against the Soviets. The NHL got a miracle, and what happened? Mario Lemieux wasn't even in the league. But so little would happen that Lemieux would get in the league and would call the NHL a garage league. And this was when Gretzky was coming into the league. You know, I don't know that I can blame the NHL. I don't know what I would have done. But they never figured out. The experts, they didn't believe much in marketing. But they never figured out how. How do you seize this miracle and wrangle it? The same way the NHL is looking at it now. They had a moment. They had a blip. They had people talking about their sport. Where it mattered in 1980 was on frozen ponds and basements. I remember Tony Amani, former Blackhawk captain. He was telling me after Mike Ruzioni scored against the Russians, Soviets, and they beat him. They beat the 4-3, the evil, dreaded Soviets. He went down to his family's basement in Massachusetts, fired slapshot after slapshot at his family's washer and dryer. That's where they were. That was the target. And the NHL had no idea what to do, but there was that little kid. There was that little kid, that Amani kid, firing puck after puck into dryers, washers. I talked to Jack O'Callaghan earlier. Defenseman of the 1980 Olympic team. I said, you saw a lot more of him in the movie than maybe his role deserved because the camera loved the actor portraying Jack. Michael Mattinuto was the actor. Here's a gold medal, the greatest victory in American sports. He didn't tell this story. We were on to other things about the miracle, but I will tell this story. The Hawks brought him in after the miracle. The greatest sporting event in history. Hold the press conference. And there he is at stadium. And he's wearing a Hawks ball cap and a Blackhawks jacket. And he's all Hawksed out, the way Jack would talk about Vladislav Tretiak, all being all Russianed up. Press conference is over with the golden boy, the Blackhawks golden boy. They drafted him. He's going to play for the team. O'Callaghan is walking toward the door when Louis Varga, the equipment guy, goes, "Hey, kid, over here." Louis Varga wanted the cap and jacket back because the Blackhawks don't give those away. This is a guy on a team, just won a gold medal, and you feted him. You made a big deal. No, sorry, you don't get the cap. You don't get the jacket. that kind of cheap and short-sighted and that kind of Bill Wirtz-ism, that was the thought dominating the league. That was, they were puppeteering John Ziegler, whoever was in charge. They believed marketing, that kind of stuff, was a waste of money. And this goes back to Bill Wirtz's dad, Arthur, the Baron of the Bottom Line, who apparently walked into Chicago Stadium one time and saw people painting the seats. And I don't know that he ordered it or not, but he said, I don't want paint on those seats. I want butts. So these are people who didn't want to spend money on marketing while they were discussing all this in West Palm Beach and on the yacht Blackhawk. That's where the horn came from, by the way. The horn in the stadium and the United Center from the Blackhawk yacht. But the thing is that the way the story played out and the way it'll have to play out now, that Amani kid that was shooting pucks at a dryer and washer in his parents' basement, family basement, in 1996, he would score the goal that would give the U.S. the gold medal in the World Cup over Canada. In Canada, by the way, where they had all those signs during that tournament said, it's our game.
The only time the U.S. has beaten Canada in a best-on-best final ever.
Mm-hmm. And Tony Amani scored the goal. Blackhawks hero scored the goal. And I was calling my Canadian friend, saying, hey, why don't you send those signs down here? It's our game now. All right. And what happened in the NHL? Nothing. The Hawks wouldn't let you see home games. You only got to see road games where the Hawks would score and nobody would cheer. Who wants to be a part of that? The NHL was still fifth in the Big Four of sports. That's how bad off it was. So to expect what you saw this week, breathtaking hockey.
Incredible.
To expect this to raise the NHL's equity percentage is ludicrous. History says you're wrong. Even with brighter leadership than the NHL had and the puppet and the criminals and all these people are just nefarious and being told to do what they needed to do by these, they were stooges for the Board of Governors. You find hockey is more like baseball than the NFL. In that, it's local. It's not national. In Canada, it's all over. Everything's local in Canada. We're in the United States. If a Hawks team win three titles, then it's big. No matter how depraved the Hawks were during that, no matter how much they were suppressing or enabling sexual abuser. A despicable group of coaches in suits. But see, here's the thing. And you're going to see it today. The NHL has never learned how to seize miracles. I don't know that I have any ideas for that. What you saw after 1980 was Jim Craig, the goaltender who played the greatest 2 weeks of his life in the 2 weeks that mattered, and was making unbelievable saves that had their Soviet players shaking their heads. He's not supposed to do that. Because 2 weeks earlier, the Soviets beat the Americans 10-3 in Madison Square Garden. Welcome to New York. Welcome to the Olympics. And there was Jim Craig. And he did a Coke commercial. And it was cute. And it was heartwarming. He was Jim Craig. Right? And you couldn't have asked for the one league that struggled, or A-League, the NBA was struggling too. You know, here's a funny thing. As I said earlier before I brought Jack on, or while I had Jack on, talking with Jack O'Callaghan, and the game, the greatest game in American sports history was on tape delay. And he was talking about the Russians weren't going to agree to a time change because the Russians were never going to agree to anything the Americans wanted. So that game was played earlier, wasn't played in prime time. It was shown on tape delay. So the U.S. team played the game, won the game, and then went back to the hotel with their family, and they had dinner, and they watched the game shown on tape delay. At the same time in the NBA, which was seemingly in as much trouble as the NHL, it just sort of not much going on. Nationally, you weren't really creating much of a footprint. The NBA Finals were on tape delay. Magic Johnson, a rookie guard for the Lakers, was jumping center in Game 6 in Philadelphia because Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had a migraine. So two of the greatest games played were on tape delay. But the point is that when you go from what you saw in the Miracle on Ice, but more recently, you're familiar with it, the Four Nations Cup, the breathless kind of hockey that U.S. and Canada gave you. At the highest level, the fastest speeds, the greatest hand-eye coordination. And now you're going to see the Blackhawks play the Blue Jackets. And the Blackhawks' best player isn't good enough to be on Team Canada.
But he may be in a year, hopefully.
So, the NHL won't capitalize on this. I don't know how to help it capitalize on this, but it will be catalyzed by 10-year-olds who watched the game. And it may show up in 15 years. May show up in 10 years. Another group of, I don't know if it'll be NHL players, maybe it'll be another group of snot-nosed college players who run up against some kind of Goliath and beat him. But the U.S. will have a moment, and it will be born of kids who watch this, were taken by it, think that that's what it could be, and want to do that when they grow up. The NHL has no idea what to do, and I can't really blame them. I don't know what to do.
Rosie, this happened in 2010, too. The 2010 Olympics is one of the things that drew me into hockey. I'm a huge hockey fan. Uh-huh. And U.S. beats Canada in the pool round. Almost the identical result of this Four Nations tournament. And then they lose in overtime. Crosby beats them in overtime. Mm-hmm. But that tournament drew me in. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking, oh, is this going to increase the ratings for the NHL?
No.
Not at all.
No.
Completely it's a non-factor.
It's a one-off. And that's the way these things go. But for a moment, hockey got a spike. All right, I'm going to take a break. When I come back, the White Sox made some news. I'll kind of explain stuff to you, and then we'll bring back an interview done on Inside the Clubhouse with the way the story unfolded, more details on what it means. Because that's what we do here. No, that's not what we do on Saturday Suckers, but that what will be what we're going to do next. Thanks for listening. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. I don't know whether to play air guitar or air drums on this. Alex?
You take the guitar, I'll take the drums.
Welcome in, welcome back. Saturday Suckage. And thank you, Bird. Got a text from Bird. Thank you, Bird. I'm just filling time, Bird. I'm one of the village people. Cowboy, cop, which one? I don't know. Today, Alex, which one? Cowboy, cop. One of the village construction workers?
Construction worker.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we and Kevin Warren will count the cranes in the sky. I thought of Norman Greenbaum this week. I couldn't figure out why. Spirit in the Sky was his hit. And it's Kevin Warren, Cranes in the Sky. Tell Spiegel to work on a parody of Cranes in the Sky, Kevin Warren, Cranes.
On it. I'll text him right now.
Do that. Yeah. So earlier on in a score incarnation, the iteration called Inside the Clubhouse, Ryan McGuffey and Bruce Levine had on John Greenberg of The Athletic. John Greenberg authored a story with help from Dan Hayes about movement afoot with the White Sox, with ownership, with maybe a succession plan. And we're going to bring you the interview that Ryan McGuffey and Bruce Levine did with John Greenberg. And explain a lot of the ins and outs and where it stands. And so the first thing is, everyone wanted to get excited on social media last night, or anti-social media. Everyone wanted to get excited that, oh, thank God, Reinsdorf's going to sell. Okay. Somewhere down the road, the White Sox will be sold. Jerry Reinsdorf probably won't do it because it will only be upon his passing that it will happen. He's instructed, told his family, sell this team. When I pass away, sell this team. But she needs someone to sell it to. You need someone willing to pay a certain price. You'd like to have that person in line. Make it easier on your kids. In a sense, you're making your own funeral arrangements. That's what's going on. So the part of this story, and part of the interview, a big part of the interview, you'll hear about the clarifications made on who's in charge and who's not. The name you may have heard before, we'll certainly hear a lot of now, is Justin Ishbia. His brother Matt, they own the Phoenix Suns, play the Bulls today, 4 o'clock, 3:45 for Chuck's pregame. So the Ishbias own the Suns and the Phoenix Mercury. And now he pulled out of a an opportunity to buy the Minnesota Twins. Why? Why? He's buying up minority ownership of the Sox. Why? Always ask why. And keep asking why. Ask why at least 5 times. My Occam's razor version in following the money is this. Jerry Reinsdorf did not want the North Shore billionaire, Justin Ishbia, going all Steve Cohen in the AL Central. If it's true that he wants to leave the White Sox in a better place, 2 things happen. You lure that guy from Minnesota into your rate suite, you give him the opportunity to buy minority shares, and there has to be, I believe there's a guarantee that he's going to get first shot, maybe only shot, at ownership upon Jerry's passing. But Jerry makes an offer, finds some way to keep from having to compete with a new version of Steve Cohen, whom he loathes because he spends money. Thanks for listening today to Saturday Suckage. What I just said, keep in mind as you hear Bruce Levine and Ryan McGuffey on Inside the Clubhouse interview John Greenberg of The Athletic.
We go to the phone lines and we welcome in our friend John Greenberg from The Athletic, who co-wrote the story with Dan Hayes. And John, thanks for joining us, buddy, here on Inside the Clubhouse on 670 The Score. Talking about your story, Justin Ishbia abandons bid for Twins to boost his stake in the White Sox. What was your biggest takeaway? We've been discussing this for the first 7-8 minutes here of the show. What's your biggest takeaway from this story?
Oh, well, one, I'd be listening if I wasn't calling, so it was no problem coming on. But, my biggest takeaway, I kind of found out through this, kind of through old-fashioned reporting here in a bit here, following up with someone else and getting a little more information every step, working with Dan. I couldn't get the confirmation on was, does this deal come with a guarantee that he will be allowed to, take control? Like, plenty of deals happen this way. I think the Guardians are in one now with David Blitzer, where you start as minority owner and then like a certain time passes and then you get the control or the rights to buy control. So I couldn't get that clarified. Obviously the White Sox quote denies that I got. So that's a little bit of a wrench. And, is there like a timeline? So those are the 2 things I was looking for that I didn't get, but I do believe from everyone I've talked to, as we did insinuate in the story, that, people in baseball believe this, that he will have, whatever, if you want to call it first rights or refusal or a guarantee to take over the White Sox after a certain amount of time. So I do think the White Sox will have a new owner, and I think it'll be Justin Ishbia.
John Greenberg on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline, CircaResortandCasino.com. John Greenberg from The Athletic joining us here.
And, John, so let's talk about the difference between buying limited partnership shares and the sale of the team. 2 different things.
Yes, 100%. And he is buying limited partnership shares right now. But, the question we had, and, literally a lot of people in baseball believe that, that have been kind of briefed on this deal, believe this deal involves a chance to buy. He didn't buy the team yet. Yeah, I mean, that's right. you know, we were pretty careful about that. So I hope fans, you know, read that and understand it. He's buying up limited partnerships, and he's doing it at a $1.8 billion valuation. And what I didn't know till, I mean, in January, Sportico broke that he was part of the group that helped fund Michael and Jonathan Reinsdorf to buy limited partners out in 2021. Now, we knew they were doing that. It was reported in Cranes. They were quoted about it. It's public. I didn't know, and I know a lot of people in the group didn't know, that Justin HBO was one of the people that provided kind of the money through a, I think it's called a special purpose vehicle.
So that means that they give percentages, like going to a bank, right? The HBOs were the bank. They use the money up front. The Reinsdorfs did their best to sell, pick up limited partnerships from the other limited partners. There's 33 limited partnerships.
Nice. Okay.
And then he gets a percentage on top of the money that he invested.
Right. So it really is kind of funny because I forgot that happened. So I was originally writing it. I was writing it as, you know, he's buying whatever. And then, you know, I was reminded that of the Sportico story. So he's really just upping his stake in the team. And, you know, the last time they did this, the valuation was, you know, I believe from what I've heard, and I'm sure you've heard too, Bruce, it was around half of what it's valued at now.
Right.
Now, when you do these things, it's at a discount. I mean, that's the purpose. You know, you're getting your money. It's just like anything else. You know, you're giving it away at a discount, but you need the money. And people, a lot of these partners are, you know, no spring chickens anymore. So some people want to get out for estate planning. Some people just, you know, I know people now, I've talked to, you know, several of them, the limited partners, some are selling and some aren't. You know, there's some people that are in different situations that can hold on and get a higher valuation when and if a deal, you know, goes through in the near future.
Now, we're not speculating, like you said, that this is like first right of refusal, but it feels and it's leaning that way. But the fact that you have Justin Ishbia that looks to be the clear front runner for the Minnesota Twins, and in your story you have, like, you know, the Twins are shocked that he pulled out of this. You know, I don't want to feel like it feels like it's a safe assumption that you're pulling out of one franchise so you can line yourself up and you're building this massive estate just miles, you know, up the road here on Lake Michigan. What type of owner? I mean, I don't even know if you can actually, you know, speculate on this, but we've seen what they've done with the Suns. They've been very fan friendly with like their menu options and stuff like that.
Sure.
But what type of ownership? And this is a guy that's been, you quoted him too. He's been quoted a lot about his love for baseball. He's 47 years old. Like, what type would this be the type of guy that fans would be excited about? Or is this something that fans should just kind of sit, put it on your back burner of your brain? Because this, at the end of the day, the control is the control, man. Jerry Reinsdorf is still in control of the Chicago White Sox.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think fans should be excited for the future if he, you know, he takes over, which, like I said, I believe he will. But, you know, here's, and I think, honestly, and I heard you guys kind of talking about before, it's, you know, Jerry has talked recently about, like, putting the franchise in a good place, you know, making it better, making sure things are better, you know, before he leaves. And this is a great choice. Here's a guy who's 47, he's local, he loves baseball, he has money. And I think, you know, we've seen this in, you know, other franchises. Like, if the owner actually has some money, he has billions of dollars. Because, like, people call Tom Ricketts a billionaire. He's not a billionaire. His dad's a billionaire. And his dad doesn't support the team. So, like, if you have billions of dollars and you can afford, you know, to maybe take some more chances and to spend more money with players that, you know, maybe the Reinsdorf group couldn't do. So I think people should be really excited. And I also think it's just, like, this has to happen eventually. You know, Jerry's 89 years old. Like, this isn't going to, you know, go on forever.
People have been saying that for 10 years. He's 79. He's 80. He's 81. When's he going to sell? Okay. The idea is that the interesting part of this is that even if this guy owns 90% of the team, Jerry is still the managing partner of the team.
Correct.
You know,
and we don't know if his shares are going to be like part of the, you know, the general partner group that Jerry controls or the minority. I would assume it's minority till a certain time.
Right.
Jerry's in control.
And Jerry's in control. And at this point in time, until he passes or decides that he's going to sell it, he is that guy. So I think the fascinating history of this is that when Jerry and Eddie Einhorn, who were the upfront owners of this team, the 33 partners that bought the team from VEC. Jerry only owned about 6% of the team at that time.
Right.
And now I think it's somewhere between 20% and 30%.
Right. He told Crane last year was more than 19. I think Forbes had estimated 19. He told Crane it was more than 19. And there's a great quote in the Trib from 2013 I used in my story where he goes, "No owner knows how much I own," which is like such a classic Jerry line.
It really is.
Yeah. John, we appreciate it so much coming on. It's a great story that you and Dan wrote, and we're going to be following it. I think it's going to be interesting to see how fans react to this part of it and the possibility down the line that Jerry is actually being proactive to sell the Chicago White Sox at some point in time, or the family will.
Yeah, I know. This is a really interesting story. And like, when I was talking to Scott Reifert, who's quoting the story, I think it's a good thing. I think being this proactive and kind of getting in front of it, and we'll see if, he talks publicly on it. I'm guessing probably not.
Probably not. Yeah. John Greenberg from The Athletic. Great job, man. Thanks for joining us this morning on Inside the Clubhouse.
All right. Thanks, guys.